Welcome to the latest episode of the Shamrock. I'm Pete Sampson, back from a quick overnight trip to Ann Arbor for a little bit of Notre Dame recruiting news, which will be the dominant topic on this podcast. Is Notre Dame scored a commitment from CJ Carr, 24/7 sports composite. He's a five-star quarterback, but unanimously a top 50 player. Probably will finish as a top 25 player on all the networks by the time it's done. When it's done, as far as this class, is another topic to talk about. But unless you've been living under a rock, you know that CJ Carr's grandfather is Lloyd Carr, one of his grandfathers. The other one is Tom Curtis, who was an All-American safety at Michigan. Both his parents went to Michigan. I think if you are a Notre Dame fan, the only thing that you would like more than landing a five-star quarterback is one that everyone thought was predestined to Michigan since he was born. So, Matt, it was a fun time on Twitter to post a photo of CJ putting a Notre Dame hat on Lloyd Carr's head, which was hilarious but also completely adorable the way the former Michigan coach sort of enjoyed the moment. I think it was a good reminder to everybody. It's like, it's just college football, right? Like it doesn't need to be much more serious than that.
Great photography work. Did you take was it six pictures?
I did take all six photos. It was like, that's great. It's a rare burst of like, Matt Kishore level inspiration that I had there.
That could be like a flip book or something, to highlight his commitment. It was really cool. You got him not really suspecting that Lloyd Carr, not suspecting that the hat's going to come onto his head, then embracing it for like a millisecond, which you caught, and then immediately taking it off and handing it back to his grandson CJ. But I'm trying to think, like, where's this rank in the pantheon of like Notre Dame Michigan rivalries, victories that have gone Notre Dame's way? I mean, there's the slip of the envelope in 2012 that essentially ended the series as we know it. A lot of context behind that amicable parting of ways that gets lost, but that one was pretty memorable. Winning 31-0 and in some people's minds 37-0 and what was the finale at that point of the series was pretty good. The one to me though that stands out even more is, I think people forget, or maybe they'll be reminded of it come September 3rd, this Ohio State series was announced the week of that Michigan finale in 2014. As one more like F you, like we don't need you in the big, well, we'll use the Big Ten. We just won't use you. And obviously fences have been mended. They've played each other twice since then and are going to play each other again in 2033 and 2034. Unfortunately, the Cars will be out of eligibility by then, but it is pretty crazy, even though it makes perfect sense when you hear everyone from that family talk, when you do some homework and understand the history here in the background. Like, it makes perfect sense why he might not want to go to Michigan. It doesn't make it any less juicy though. Like, of all those programs for him to not like to go to instead of Michigan. Like, it's one thing if he goes to Alabama, Georgia, Oregon, to go to like your like-minded rival 3 hours down the road, who you're so bitter at that you don't even play now on an annual basis. That one's got to stick in the craw of Michigan fans. And that one, if you're a Notre Dame fan, is pretty darn sweet. I can't think of too many modern comparisons or what would even be an equivalent. I mean, Notre Dame losing Jaden Ivey to Purdue, like that's a head scratcher in a similar vein, but he went to Purdue. He didn't go to Michigan or Duke or another, basketball rival. Before we recorded here, I was trying to come up with a list of anything similar, and I really couldn't think of any.
No, nothing at that, because it's a quadruple legacy is just sort of like hard to be in the first place.
Well, and he's really freaking good. This isn't like, oh yeah, three-star tight ends coming. Like, this will be fun. Yes. Like, no, it's the best offense recruit they've got in more than a decade.
Yeah, it's the franchise quarterback that you've been trying to land for 3 years and finally got. So that's all part of it. But yeah, it was refreshing to sort of, talk to Lloyd Carr and him be a good sport about it. And he was just like, yeah, I just assumed he was always going to go to Michigan. But talking to Jason, his dad, who actually was a quarterback at Michigan. And I was joking with him afterwards, cause he was there when like Michigan's quarterback run was like insane. They just had NFL guys every year. And I think he said his senior year was Tom Brady's freshman year, if I'm not mistaken. But it was like, you know, Elvis Gerbach and Brian Greasy. And he was just like, maybe I was really good, but I just never got to play because I was behind these NFL quarterbacks the whole time. But he said he remembered, because I was trying to get to the root of like, when and why did CJ want to leave? When did you know that? And he was like, it was before, it was well before he started playing tackle football. As I said, it was like in middle school. And he was just like, Dad, you, so let me get this straight. You grew up in Ann Arbor. You went to college in Ann Arbor and you live in Ann Arbor. And he's like, I would never do that. That's crazy. Like who would do such a thing? So, I mean, the family knew he was always leaving. And in some ways, they felt the mom, Tammy and Jason, like, all right, well, now that he's really good at this football thing, like maybe the pull to stay home will be a little bit greater. And it just never was. And I mean, it's interesting talking to people around Notre Dame. They, when the recruitment started, they're like, you really looking at us? Like, are you just jerking our chain here? and like coaches at Michigan State felt the same way. Like, come on, give me a break. You're not coming here. And CJ insisted and insisted and insisted. And I think finally, in the case of Tommy Reese, who was the primary recruiter here, Reese sort of fell in love with CJ Carr and vice versa. And that connection wasn't enough to get Notre Dame over the line entirely, but was the biggest of the relationships that got the job done.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Like, I'm just trying to, we'll never be able to put ourselves in the shoes of a five-star quarterback, but like, I remember when I first got to high school, which was like six blocks from NYU, and I'm like, oh, NYU looks awesome. I'd love to go to college there. And everyone's like, no, you don't go to college in the same neighborhood that you went to high school at. And then I was like, oh, I want to go to Syracuse. They have a great broadcast school. I love their basketball team. I see him at the Garden. And then it's like, everyone from my neighborhood's going to Syracuse. Like, I don't want to do the same thing as everyone else. Like, I think what in some ways softens the blow for CJ himself is that because he's such a famous name locally, like because he has that legacy, like it's not like he'll be hated in Ann Arbor. Like, he's still Lloyd Carr's grandson. He's still Jason Carr's son. He's not a random five-star who's like, screw this place, I'm out of here. He'll be able to live his life just fine in a way that I'm not sure it would have been, given how crazy recruiting can be.
I didn't,
with some of these.
I mean, I was just meeting the family for the first time yesterday, so I didn't want to get like too deep on the family stuff. And you know, like if you're watching college football in 2015, you remember the Chad Tough movement,
right?
And what that meant to not just Michigan, but like what it meant around the Big Ten. Certainly, what it meant to the family. I mean, they have a foundation to raise money for research and DIPG, and I mean, their benefit is in Chrysler Arena. That will continue, I'm sure, and CJ Carr will attend it. Like, it. There's so many things about this family, and like I don't pretend to know them well, but I got to know them a little bit yesterday, and like they come across as like great people that would be easy to root for. And I think even in this very tribal college football society that we live in, where it's like you're either for us or against us, I would think the majority of Michigan fans, for all the reasons you mentioned and I mentioned, like, will support a Notre Dame quarterback in a way that they've never supported a Notre Dame quarterback before, because of like what that family has poured into the University of Michigan already.
Yeah, I think our colleague Austin Meek, who covers Michigan for us, had a good story up last night after the announcement. And I think it spoke to that. It was, look, like no one, well, maybe Notre Dame, but no one loves their like history and legacies and cheering on one of their own more than Michigan does. You know, no program likes to remind you of its past the way Michigan does. And for that reason, nothing would have made fans happier than to see Lloyd Carr's grandson.
Notre Dame doesn't do that at all.
So. Throwing touchdowns at the Big House. But because of everything you just said, because no one in Ann Arbor who was in the know was particularly blindsided by this, and because it's such a respected family that has done so much for the community over multiple generations, like, it's not like end of the world. Oh my God. It's like, tip your cap. We're happy for you. We wish you were here, but we understand. And now we got to go get Dante Moore, which I don't know if Michigan's going to get him, but nor do I think Notre Dame will get him, but we can touch that. We can get to that a little bit later. I know some fans were panicking about that last night, the CJ Carr news. But, I mean, what was the scene like? I know it wasn't at the actual high school. I know there are only a handful of reporters there. We were talking offline earlier. I guess, you know, you missed the Brady Quinn and some of the interview stuff that we all saw online because it wasn't broadcast in the auditorium. But what was the scene like, especially since, you know, we all knew exactly what was going to happen as far as who he's going to choose.
Yeah, there was no drama about it because before the broadcast went on at 7, like, they posed for pictures with their Notre Dame stuff. So there wasn't, you know, it was just like, hey, could you not tweet this out? Yes, no problem. so, yeah, there was just a, I think it was more like, all right, let's just get to the finish line. You can see it. You have to just run the last half mile of this marathon here, or this sprint, or the last 100 meters of the sprint, or whatever track analogy you want to use. And so then there's relief. I think, you know, one of the things that I didn't get this into the story, but like after it was done, I think that Tammy, like, they closed the laptop, the stream went off from CBS because they were done with it, and they were just like, huge exhale. Whew, okay, like, we're done. Huge hugs, and then, you know, applause, and then he could sort of enjoy it. You know, I think that, not that there was pressure to commit to Notre Dame, or like there wasn't tension about where he was going to go, what decision he was going to make, but it's still a big, big deal, and he's still, I think, 17 minutes from Michigan Stadium while he's doing this. Like, that's a big deal. You know, Lloyd Carr mentioned talking to him, like, I coached a lot of the staff members on Harbaugh's staff. Like, those were my kids when I was a head coach. So that's, you know, I think they walked successfully, I think, like, walked a very fine line of, you know, it's CJ's decision. It's his life. But also trying to be respectful of, a place that meant so much to the family. So it wasn't tense. It was just like, I think it was just more of like, okay, finish this, hold your breath. But then when you're done, it was kind of like this joyous relief in the room. And then everyone could just sort of like open up. I mean, CJ said like he could have committed in April. He was ready to do it. He said his dad wanted him to see a few other places just to be sure. You know, I asked him about, like, did that give you a chance to sort of like wear the decision around without anyone knowing? And it's like, yeah, just like you kind of get comfortable with it that way. But it was not, there wasn't a lot of tension there. It was just like, okay, just get to the end, finish this last thing, and then it's over. Then everyone will know. You can kind of stop trying to keep something in that you've been wanting to get out for quite some time.
I'll give you pressure. Brady Quinn coming on the show immediately after and saying, I want you to break all my records, win the Heisman, win a national championship. No pressure. But Brady did, he offered an appropriate analogy as far as growing up in Ohio and the pull of Ohio State. And even after committing to Notre Dame, how much the Buckeyes were still after him. And he kept saying, I'm good. Like, it's not, again, I can't think of too many appropriate analogies. Like, as far as like local college quarterbacks, like Justin Herbert staying in Eugene to go to Oregon was not a big deal at the time because no one really knew who he was outside of Oregon. Mack Brown whiffed on every Austin-born QB during the latter half of his tenure, so I think there's more anger at the program and not the players in retrospect from Texas fans. But I think, you know, the way you described CJ, the way you described the family, us knowing him the way we know him, I don't think it's a surprise that he and Tommy Rees hit it off as well as they did. Like, when you talk about as close to like normal of a human being and guys in coaching at a high level, I think Tommy Rees fits the bill with that. Not that there aren't other people like that in other parts of the country, but, you know, most college coaches are freaking nut jobs.
Yes.
And Rees and most of the guys we got to know on this Notre Dame staff are not of that ilk, at least not yet. So, I mean, you could speak to the relationship better than most can, but why do you think it is that those two hit it off as well as they did?
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I think it's because Carr is a little bit of like a football junkie and understands like every bit of work you put in gives you an advantage on the field later. And Reese, who I don't know if you listened to Reese's Inside the Garage interview. I think it came out before the spring game. But
I've heard Freeman's, which was great, but I haven't heard
it's the next Reese's episode. Yet. There's some good insightful parts of it. But Reese talked about like, look, I'm not a great athlete at all. So if I was going to play, I was going to have to work my ass off the field. And Carr is a much more natural athlete than Reese will ever be. But there's some similarities in terms of like how much work he likes to do off the field. Jason, the dad, was telling me about, you know, they would Zoom and Reese would install a play from the offense. And, okay, this is how I draw it up. This is how I install it. If it's man defense, these are your reads. If it's zone, these are your reads. And then he would essentially like stop talking and CJ would then have to kind of like parrot it back or show some mastery or understanding of just a singular play. And Jason said CJ's reaction to this was like, holy crap, I'm learning a college offense. How cool is this? You know, that's the kind of level of work he likes to put in with this stuff. And that's somebody who's going to really relate to Reese. And you know, one of the byproducts of this is like every player learns differently. That process also allowed Tommy to figure out how CJ learns and let CJ figure out how Tommy teaches. You know, it's going to be a minute before they're together on a roster here, and that would require Tommy sticking around. But that there's a very close relationship there. Beyond that, it was interesting to sort of hear. I talked to one of CJ's sort of personal quarterbacks coaches, and he said, I'll be honest with you, if this was the old staff, I don't think CJ Carr would be going to Notre Dame. And I was like, hold up.
Even like, with Reese on it?
Yeah. I was like, well, Reese is here. And he's like, yeah, but there was no relationship with the head coach at all. Like, he doesn't like.
Really? Are you serious, Pete?
I'm serious. So he's like, he doesn't like to be coached the way that Brian Kelly coaches. And so I asked Jason, I asked CJ, like, did you meet with Brian Kelly when he came to summer camp last year or when he came to the USC game? He did not. There wasn't a relationship there. Marcus Freeman comes in. CJ Carr comes back for spring practice. Marcus Freeman is all over him. You know, building a relationship, talking, figuring out things they have in common, you know, getting a foundation there to the point where I think when he committed, I didn't put this in the story, but I think this is when this happened. Like they did a Zoom and Marcus was on there. The Carr family all wearing Notre Dame stuff, except for the dad, Jason. And Marcus felt comfortable enough to sort of give him shit about it. And just be like, what's the deal here, Jason? Like, where's your Notre Dame stuff? And he's like, he's had a similar reaction to the way Lloyd Carr has. Like, I'll get there. Just like, I need some time on this, but I will get there. But you can't give people shit unless you know them. You can't give people shit unless you have a relationship with them. And like, as we have seen in recruiting, Marcus Freeman is a very skilled relationship builder with people, which is why that's how you get commitments like CJ Carr. That helps you get over the line as long as the position coach relationship can get you to the line in the first place.
Yeah, I thought you were going to reference the fire alarm that you put in the story. Yeah, that was awesome. Set off when
casually dropped that. I'm like, oh god, this is gold. I'm assuming Chad Bowden pulled it, but I can't. No, for sure. I'll have to find
out. That sounds like it would line up. I was going to, not to harp on it, but I mean, it was hard not to notice that line in your story about the Carrs not meeting with Brian Kelly at Irish Invasion or during USC weekend. And like, at risk of beating a dead horse, I mean, look, listeners of this podcast know me and you would said this in real time. Like, yeah. Like there's a reason happening. We wrote so many, like, how the hell does this guy keep winning so many games? Like, obviously he's a great coach, but like the recruiting absence, if you will, was so glaring and even more glaring in comparison to someone who's doing it the complete opposite way right now from that seat. It's just crazy. Like, especially when you're like an offensive guy, right? Like
a quarterback, for Christ's sake, a five-star quarterback, like the position, you know, you need to get you over the top, obviously, without doubt. Like, you don't even have a conversation about it. They wouldn't be all over those guys is just totally bizarre to me. I just can't get my head around it.
Again, who are we to question them? They won a hell of a lot of football games under him. And he's going to do really well at LSU. I don't know if he'll win at all, but he's going to win big there. But man, it's just like, how? Like, how? Like, it still doesn't track for me. I guess going to the big picture. Well, first, I mean, he keeps saying he doesn't want to do it, but it's been talked about enough where we're going to keep asking the question until we get a definitive answer. Is there a chance CJ Carr reclassifies? What would it take in order for that to happen?
Yeah, okay. So the answer is, short answer is yes, there's a chance it could happen. He says right now, no, he's not going to do it. However, he plans to take courses this summer and has taken courses in previous summer to allow that. And I mean, when I first heard this was in the water, I was like, all right, hold up. I mean, Notre Dame admissions is like no joke. Like, they have their hard, fast rules. They're not, and those rules are not, you need to be in high school for 4 years. Those rules are, you have to have a certain amount of courses, core courses to get in. CJ Carr is right now he's old for his grade. He's a May birthday. So he was 17 years old as a high school sophomore. In eighth grade, the family made the decision to sort of hold him back and let him get older. He took a little bit of a gap year, this is a story I want to do down the road. But so he played football in the fall, and then he went on two mission trips, one to Haiti, I believe to work at an orphanage affiliated with Mitch Albom, and then also to Nicaragua. So he had like this different world perspective. He was able to sort of like physically grow, but he was out of school. Then he comes back, does, you know, returns to school. So when he entered, by the time he enters high school, he already has credits. So he's just sort of been ahead academically the whole time. You know, when his high school coach was there and he got up and sort of said the opening remarks before the ceremony goes. And when he said, he made a reference to like, I look forward to, you know, coaching CJ for the next 2 years. Like, it was kind of affected language. You could hear like that there was something loaded in saying the 2 years, right? So I think it's just going to be an ongoing thing. It was sort of left talking to the family. If you could just sort of distill this down into like, right now they don't plan to do it, but they also plan to give themselves the option to do it if they change their minds, which makes sense. You know, give yourself maximum options. If Notre Dame doesn't sign a quarterback in 2023, I would assume that would make it a lot more attractive, but we're not in a situation where you would come in and challenge for the starting job as a reclassified quarterback. You would just sort of be on the team. It would be because you're ready to do something else other than play high school football, not because you would think you would come in and beat out a junior Tyler Buchner for the job. So it's going to be an ongoing thing. It sounds like Notre Dame's open to it. Family's open to it. They're going to continue to talk about it in terms of like meeting with admissions. Okay, what do you actually need for this? So we can make sure that we check every box necessary. But right now the plan is not to do it. But like you said, it's going to be something that we're going to keep talking about until like you get past the point of no return on like either coming or not coming. But I think they like to give themselves the option to do it.
Yeah. Mitch Albom, didn't think we'd get a five people you meet in heaven reference here, but I guess that's appropriate for Notre Dame. It reminds me of Romeo Cara, first enrolled, and Bob Diaco challenged us all to find out whether he's the youngest person on campus. Cause I think he was 16 at the time. He was a true freshman, and that's already younger than high school junior to be CJ Carr is right now. If they can make it work, I mean, look, that's a good option to have in your back pocket. Again, to each his own. I can come up with plenty of good and bad reasons why he might want to do that or not want to do that. But I mean, the guy's already proven himself, right? Like if he doesn't think he's going to get much out of a fourth year of high school football, and if Notre Dame's willing to make it happen and take him, it sounds like this is an understanding family that's not expecting him to walk into Notre Dame a year from now and be the starting quarterback of the 2023 Irish roster. I just think,
if you
think you'll get more out of redshirting or playing the number two role as a quarterback in Notre Dame than you would as a fourth year as a varsity starter in high school, more power to you. I mean, less injury risk, more. I mean, there's just a million different other factors, more familiarity with the coaching staff, which again, at this rate, by the time he's currently scheduled to enroll, who knows what that staff will look like a couple of years from now. I think it could make sense if that's something that both sides have the appetite to do.
Yeah, that's, I think that's their perspective. It's, you know, I mean, the broad waving my arms general public, like we all want an answer for this. And like, they just don't have one right now, which is fine. They don't need to have one right now. So that it depends a lot on like, you know, what Notre Dame chooses to do with Dante Moore moving forward, like what kind of pursuit they want to keep up on that. It's, I'm sure you and I, we've talked to a lot of people around Notre Dame who have expressed a lot of confidence about Dante Moore up until about Monday of last week, which is the same day that they pulled the fire alarm and the Goog for the car alarm because CJ Carr was committing. If I was a betting man, I would say that Dante Moore would sign at either Oregon or A&M or LSU or Florida or Miami, a school like that. As much as early in the process, people said like, oh, he's going to stay in the Midwest. He's going to stay in the Midwest and stay in the Midwest. Like, the NIL deals are not in the Midwest. The NIL deals are in the South or they're on the West Coast. So that's where I would, my hunch now is that, you know, whether CJ Carr reclassifies or not, that Dante Moore won't be part of Notre Dame's recruiting picture next season.
I have a hard time seeing it, and it has been a pretty stark and sudden contrast from everything we'd been hearing throughout much of the spring up until this past week. Again, like, so many people think they can read inside the mind of a 17-year-old that it's hard to put too much weight into anything until ink meets paper. But the one consistent thing I did hear all along about Dante Moore was like, he's a family guy. He's more of a homebody. Like, he's going to stay in the Midwest. And based on everything you just said and everything we've seen unfold, I'm seeing that harder and harder. I have a hard time not seeing him go to Oregon or A&M or maybe even LSU, which would be an interesting storyline in its own right, given everything we had just said. But that's the reality of the business right now. That's the reality of college football recruiting right now. And you know, indirectly of what just happened this week, that recruitment has suddenly become a lot more interesting for the casual college football fan to follow, because you don't know where he's going to go. It looked pretty clear a month ago. It doesn't look clear at all right now. And by all accounts, the talent there is real, and that's a 2023 quarterback, not a 2024 quarterback, a guy who's going to be relevant on the national college football scale a lot sooner than CJ Carr likely will be. So that will be interesting to unfold. But need I remind everyone, Notre Dame is the number one recruiting class in the country without him right now. Not to diminish his importance, but to go back to our earlier point of head coach involvement with recruitment. I know it's early. Like, Northwestern, I think, is number six right now. Like, they're not going to stay in there. Michigan's number 31 right now. They're not going to stay in that far down. But the Freeman effect, the Reese effect, has been very, very real so far. And it really shows no signs of slowing down, especially after this week.
No, it's, you know, they have eight official visitors in this weekend on top of nine commitments in for this weekend. You know, Caleb Downs is a five-star safety. Jason Moore, four-star defensive lineman. Monroe Freeling, four-star offensive lineman. Jaden Osbury, whose dad is a longtime LSU sort of athletic department guy, he's in town. Rico Flores, four-star receiver from California. Mike Atiz, four-star athlete from Oklahoma. Ronan Hennepin is a three-star athlete from, I believe, Massachusetts, out east. And then Christian Gray is a four-star corner from St. Louis, who is not a must-get for Notre Dame, but pretty close. you know, kind of one of those guys that fits everything that you're looking for. He's down to, I think it's USC, LSU, Notre Dame, and there's one other school in the mix there. So it's, and CJ Carr told me he's coming back to Notre Dame this weekend to help recruit, which is another thing. Like Dante Moore is, I think, in a passing camp this weekend and then taking a visit to A&M. CJ Moore is getting back to Notre Dame to sort of help the business of Notre Dame football be better, because he's like, it helps them, it helps me. So it, I would not bet against Marcus Freeman in recruiting. You know, if you look at these eight guys who are on campus this weekend, I feel like Notre Dame's probably going to end up with four of them at least, to go on top of the 14 commitments they have. And then they have another round of official visitors coming in next weekend that includes Jaden Greathouse, who's a receiver from Austin that Notre Dame feels very confident in as well. So it, the momentum Notre Dame has in recruiting is undeniable. And I think even Austin, our colleague who covers Michigan, wrote this in his piece, like, what's a better head coach, offense coordinator, recruiting tandem right now than Marcus Freeman and Tommy Rees, which I had never written and I hadn't really thought about. And I was like, well, probably a pretty good point.
Right.
You know, what they have, they have mojo right now.
They coach one game together, but
yeah, but recruiting, they're killing it.
Yeah.
It's there's just a lot of positive momentum on that front for Notre Dame. And I think that will probably continue unabated up until December when, let's be honest, I think some NIL rubber is going to hit the road with some kids when they're like, all right, we need a defensive end. Here's a $1.5 million NIL deal. And Notre Dame might have a hard time with that. So until then, I think Notre Dame's going to continue on this pretty impressive recruiting ride where, you know, you have coaches who are just like on their stuff and you have a head coach who demands it and is part of the solution on the day-to-day parts of recruiting. And that all adds up in the end. And I think we're kind of seeing that now.
Yeah. I mean, you tweeted this earlier this week. They had two graduating eighth graders out West who reported offers from Notre Dame this week. I mean, that's a departure from years past. I mean, the hype is real as far as on the recruiting trail. I mean, I'm sure we've talked about this, but like when Freeman got there as a defense coordinator a year ago, we were hearing from people in Columbus who were like, all right, we got to actually like pay attention to Notre Dame right now for some of these kids. We never really had to consider them into the equation when offering in-state kids. And now it's like, holy cow, like the recruiting machine is really rolling on. And we've talked about it endlessly. Like Notre Dame was one of the best, I wouldn't call it a developmental program because they were beyond that, but they were one of the best programs at getting the absolute most out of the talent on the roster year in and year out, which is why they won all the games they were supposed to win, why they had that long winning streak against unranked opponents, why they were able to make multiple college football playoff appearances under Brian Kelly. But clearly when you get to that level, there is a difference in horsepower between the teams that are winning in the playoff and the teams that are coming up short and just getting there. We saw that Franklin, Michigan against Georgia this past year in the semifinals after a great regular season for the Wolverines. And to see Notre Dame operating the way they are right now, I think is kind of coming to fruition in the way that I think me and you always thought they might have been capable of if they had the right kind of messenger.
And there. Private and jets for assistance, which they do now too.
Yeah, I want to get behind the story behind that. I mean, there were a group of them on one. It wasn't yes. like they're all.
Yeah, well, it's not like everybody all the time, but it's happening a little bit more. And I feel like the Shamrock has sponsored this movement.
Right. We need like a Nets Jets ad or something. We need to hit up our boy Tom Mendoza and fly right. private to the next game. But I'll be curious to see how they do on the field this fall, because, again, the schedule is infinitely tougher, at least from the offseason vantage point than it's been in years past, which means probably more losses than usual, but we don't know that. I'll be curious how this momentum carries over or doesn't carry over into the season. And by that, I mean, if they go 8-4 this year, are they going to get laughed off on the recruiting trail at this time next year, coming off a mediocre season by their standards, probably not being in the NIL game the way that some of their competitors, at least at the national level, are. and what that will mean for some of these prospects. But right now, I mean, it's full speed ahead, and it's been pretty riveting to watch just see this program take off operationally.
We'll do a full podcast on the Notre Dame fan survey results, which will get published next week. You mentioned sort of like, what if they go 8-4? One of my questions that I put in there every year is, how would you define a successful season? And the number one answer with 38.5% of the vote, this is like the minimum for success, where you'd be like, I would take it, I'm happy with this, or at least I'm happy with this, maybe not, I'd take it. Number 38.5% was win a New Year's Six bowl game. 37.8% was win 10 games, win a minor bowl game, sign a top five recruiting class. I also asked, what will Notre Dame's regular season record be? 52.7% said 10-2. 27.1% said 9-3. So I think that the fan base is sort of like moderated a little bit to like give Marcus Freeman the benefit of the doubt for a full year. Now that's different than going 8-4 and losing 35-3 at Ohio State and getting waxed at USC in the end. But I think that Notre Dame plays for national championships and only like that's the only thing that matters. I think the fan base is sort of had a more big picture perspective on like the program itself, what success looks like, and how this is the first year of the Marcus Freeman era, not the 12th year. So granting him the benefit of time and learning is something that I think the fan base is going to be willing to do.
Yeah, there's definitely a sense of wanting to believe in him. Not that like it takes much convincing when you hear him talk and you see what he's done so far, but like, everything he's touched right now is golden. And I know it's a honeymoon period for every first year coach in the country right now, but I think given the way he's operated, given the way he's been able to connect with everyone, given the program he's taken over, there's a belief that he's going to find a way to get this done. Maybe not this year, maybe not next year, but at some point he's going to be the guy to get this program over the proverbial hump and win a national championship again. Like when you covered Brian Kelly's first year and the kind of introductory tour that he went on the way Marcus Freeman is now. And I got there in year two, but I just never, you could speak to this better than I can, but I think given the state of the program and given how hard Brian Kelly had to sell it and just his personality, it was kind of a cautious optimism, if you will.
I think it was reluctance. I remember talking to Notre Dame's deputy AD at the time, Bill Scholl, about that, and he's like, he said, I'm paraphrasing here because it was a conversation from 12 years ago, but like he was like, I think there's some real like cautiousness about like, we hope this works, but the last 10 years have been really bad, and people just sort of got numb to going 8-4,
right?
Yeah, and then they come out of the gate and go 8-4, but or 7-5. So it's, Freeman just takes over a completely different program than Kelly did. So I think that the ability for fans to be all in and sort of get behind Freeman is in part down to the success that Brian Kelly had over the last 5 years. Because you're not wondering, can Notre Dame win?
Right.
Like, that question's already been answered. Now it's like, can Notre Dame win at all? Which is, if you're a Notre Dame fan, a hell of a lot more fun question to ask than can Notre Dame win at all?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think Kelly was a guy who, and still is a guy who has won big everywhere he's been. So I think there's a sense of like anxiousness, maybe. I don't know. Like look at like Nebraska right now, right? Which was a once great, proud program that's fallen on hard times, and they got the pretty much only guy that any of us thought they could have and should have got to revive that program. It's been terrible. And now the question is like, can they ever be good ever again?
Yeah, that's
this climate.
That's a
Notre Dame was on the brink of that.
Yeah, that question is scary as hell to ask if you're a fan. And I think that with Kelly, when he came in, it was like, well, if it doesn't work with this guy, we're the problem, not the guy we're hiring.
Right.
That all has been like pushed by the wayside by Brian Kelly's success over the last 5 years. So that, you know, it's just like the ability to sort of reach higher and go for it is you have a head coach who feels like a guy who wants to reach higher and go for it. So that's really easy to get behind.
Yeah, the messaging was different because it had to be different. I mean, I remember, I think it was probably the same. I think it was the Rock Miguel, the Chicago club in 2012, maybe. I didn't go to it, but I had a number of friends did. I remember it became at least a message board story, if not a story where Brian Kelly had to actually answer it at a press conference. But he had a line there. It would have been, you know, it would have been going into 2012 where he said something to the effect of like, if we win 8 games this year, this will be the first time we've won 8 games 3 years in a row since whatever. And like, it makes sense. Like, I get what he's trying to say, but it was something that went over like a fart in church with that fan base.
Yeah.
Like, it just didn't, it was like 8 games. We didn't hire you to win 8 games, man. You've done that 2 years in a row already. And it's been so, like, we hired you to bring us back. And again, like, Brian Kelly's a great program builder. Like, there's one stark difference between him and the guy he succeeded, Charlie Weiss. It was that, right? Weiss had a kind of a flash in the pan 2 seasons and clearly didn't have a plan worth a damn after that. Brian Kelly was trying to illustrate the difference between the two, and given the state of the program at that point, that just wasn't the messaging that I think anyone had the appetite for. Whereas now we know what Notre Dame's capable of. We have a fairly good idea that they're probably capable of more, at least as far as the talent they can bring in.
Yeah. And we know they're capable of more because the more is recruiting.
Right.
And we're seeing that happen now.
Right. And we don't hear the same excuses inside the Goog that we'd always hear in previous regimes about, well, we can't do this, or would you rather this or that? Like, now it's like, no excuses. Let's go out there and do it. Now it's not as simple as, you know, fantasy football, right? Where you build a roster and ta-da, like, I've got the best stats. We're going to win. Maybe we've always said, getting X number of kids in Notre Dame can be a challenge. The real challenge is not getting them into the school. It's meshing them into university lifestyle / getting them on track to graduate, because there was a lot of excitement over Brian Kelly's early recruiting classes as well. Not to this extent by any stretch of the imagination, but you look back on the number of whiffs and the number of risks that he took that just fell flat on their face. It's pretty sizable. I think now that there's a formula, so to speak, of how to make this work, and now they're going to reach higher, makes everyone a little bit more comfortable with the way things are going. And I'm just very curious and fascinated to see how it plays out over not just this year, but in the years to come, you know, when they do hit adversity. And I wouldn't even, you know, losing a New Year's Six bowl game that they were in control of for 2.5 quarters could fall under that category. But again, like, there weren't any real expectations with that game. It was still, hey, everyone stayed other than Brian Kelly. We're happy to be here. You know, we're coaching with half a staff right now. Like, would have been better to win than lose, obviously. But I don't look at that as like a program setback or black mark or any true sign of adversity, which inevitably will come probably on September 3rd.
There's no doubt about that. So it's let's save the rest of the fan survey for next week's podcast. We can just sort of go through it question by question, because I'll have a story up on that early next week, just sort of detailing kind of the temperature of the fan base, which I always find kind of interesting to gauge in the summer. So we'll get into that next week. I have a feeling we'll have some more recruiting stuff to talk about as well.
We got to shout out the late, great Roger Baldessari before we sign off here. If you don't know him, do your homework. Hopefully Notre Dame will do it for you.
Read a story on The Athletic.
Yeah. Yeah. We republished a story from 2019 where I sat with him. The Cliff Notes version of it is everything you love about Notre Dame can largely be attributed to the way this guy sold the place. He was a sweetheart of a human being. He was the head of PR there for 40 plus years. Died last week at the age of 95, peacefully around his family. His grandson, Nick, who was his roommate for a time in South Bend, worked in Notre Dame's recruiting department. He's now working at Vanderbilt with Clark Lee. Roger was one of a kind. He's become known nationally for changing the pronunciation of Joe Theismann to Joe Theismann to rhyme with Heisman. As we all know, that's the name he still goes by to this day. But, you know, ask anyone from those eras, media, players, coaches, Nothing but great things to say about him, and he deserves a proper send-off for everything he did for the place.
Absolutely, an institution around Notre Dame. You knew him way better than I did. I only sort of exchanged greetings and passings with him, but Tim Priester, the late great Loose Emoji, like, swore by this guy. Didn't always like him, but grew to love him. And I think that was, he's part of this place. If you're in sports media, that is a Hall of Fame name around Notre Dame, Baldessari.
Absolutely.
All right. On that note, we'll wrap up this episode of the Shamrock. Matt and I will be back next week to talk a little Notre Dame fan survey. And at some point, I said that we would do a live show, and we will. So we'll get to that.
Columbus?
I meant just like a live Q&A with our listeners, a live room. Yeah. But
I did go
on Ari and Bill's podcast. They're our Ohio State guys. And we were sort of workshopping the ideas of where our live Shamrock 4-6 A to B mashup podcast would be in Columbus on September 2nd. But
You know where the title of that podcast came from?
I have no idea, actually.
Oh, Urban Meyer like saying, like, for his players, like, why you go from 4 to 6 seconds is length of a play.
Okay.
A to B, like, get from point A to point B in 4 to 6 seconds, like one of those mental, like, focus on the play in front of you, process oriented ways of thinking. And given that they're Ari and Bill, it made sense. But they kept the name. I'm just trying to think if we based our name off Brian Kelly sayings.
Would it be like the RKG podcast or what? Like
the RKG?
I don't know what it would be.
The traits.
One of the popular, it was a Wordle thing from last week that I enjoyed. And that when I tweeted that out, I was like, I just can't wait to read the replies on this. And sure enough, they were great. So.
Oh, they were. It's funny. I did it like at midnight the night before because I was still up. And it was one of those ones where I guessed, I got really, my first, do you have a first word?
I usually go with learn. That's a popular first word, but I do change it up a little. Just something with a double vowel.
I always do steak because you can usually get at least one out of that. Yeah. But I took a random guess and I think I came up with like trail or something. Like I was really close on my second one. And I'm like, I really want to put traits in for the next one. But I'm like, that's like my bias. Like I've heard this word so much. No one would actually put this in a Wordle kind of situation. And of course, it actually was Wordle. Can we share what your wife guessed?
Yeah, let me pull it up. Because like, I think I got trait.
With your hint.
A trait on the fourth one. And then, I sort of tweeted out like, if you're a Wordle person, today's will make you think of Brian Kelly. Because like when I think I did train as my third word.
That's, I did trail, train, trait as my second, third, fourth.
And then I was like, you're effing kidding me. It's trait. but my lovely wife, who I'll keep nameless for her anonymity. Her first guess was Cajun. Got the A, but in the wrong spot. Then she went with reach. So got the R in the wrong spot, the A in the right spot. Then went with praise. Got the T and the R in the correct spot. Then went to irate.
Surprised that wasn't the first guess.
Yeah, getting closer. And then finally settled on trait. So I thought that she had some creative thinking to get to the end.
Well, if we couldn't get by with Domes and Domers as our title, there's no way we could have gotten by with a Brian Kelly themed title. Especially since we never thought he'd actually leave
late
have to rebrand in his podcast. In his tenure.
So I'm glad we stuck with the Shamrock, and I'm glad.
I don't think that's going anywhere.
No.
As far as its relationship with Notre Dame.
We're good with that. So the Shamrock is here to stay. I feel like we're a success story in the podcast universe. So until we return next week with a little fan survey talk, some more recruiting. He's Matt. I'm Pete. Thanks for being with us on the latest episode of the Shamrock.